Tonight we're entering upon the theme of activities in the other world. Obviously, we can't know very much about this, but there are some hints and some clues. Gathering them together, thinking about them, will give us some vague idea anyway. Certainly enough to tell us that there's more to do than sit on clouds. Some of the things that we traditionally have believed about life after death. Now, in some of the previous classes, we've had some other references to activities in the other world. Can you recall any of them? Witnessing the reality of every sanctified soul. Okay? That's it? All right. That's one of the things we'll want to do in the next world. We'll want to meet other souls. We'll want to see other souls and see how they embody the Spirit of God, the unseen Spirit of God that becomes mirrored and reflected in sanctified or pure-hearted souls. Every facet, every individual that we see will reflect that light in a rich and unique and different way than every other soul. So we'll be very keen about this. Everything will be like a new revelation, a new little something additional, maybe something stupendously additional to every other soul that we meet. What else? Who Abdu'l-Bahá, in this vision that he had, said he was preparing him to be a professor in the University of the Kingdom. Probably that's not a text, but it's, there seems to be something about the school of God. Even Baha'u'lláh speaks about it in the Aqdas, that he attended this school before the creation was set up. Got some divine, eternal indications there of whatever it is he needed to know. What else? Pray for souls in this world. Activity in the other world is praying for our loved ones and for others here. Attain the presence of God in the next world. What does that mean? Have we had an explanation that tells us what attaining to the presence of God in the next world consists of? Attaining the presence of the manifestation of God, seeing the now, if you talk about witnessing sanctified souls, imagine what it must be like to witness the manifestations of God in the next world, with the veils removed and the full splendor of their position revealed.
Didn't you refer to
Mm-hmm. What was he doing? He was diffusing the divine fragrances. Yes. In Memorials of the Faithful, in the accounts that Abdu'l-Bahá has written about some of the outstanding faithful believers in the past, he recounts, he's talking about one particular Baha'i there, and he says he was a great teacher. He said one night he had a dream about him, and he saw in this dream, he saw this gentleman in the next world, and he was very happy. He said he'd just come back from a trip. He'd been in this beautiful areas. The food was very good over there, and he'd met lots of souls, and he was very excited. He'd been diffusing the divine fragrances, and Abdu'l-Bahá makes a footnote to this, and he says diffusion of the divine fragrances is the term for teaching in the next world. Of course, there's also a term for teaching in this world. Sometimes in the tablets you see that too. So it sounds like you have teaching activities over there. and you'll be eating something. We don't know what it is, but we're told we can drink of the four rivers of paradise, which stand for the four different qualities divine revelation. What are those? You know? Gosh, will you know them when you see them? Four of them. What do you think they might be? Milk, one. Water, two. Wine, three. Honey, four. Got them. Those stand for what? What do those stand for? We don't know absolutely, but I mean, the Baha'i teachers have given some interpretations. Mainly Mirza Abul Fazl has said this. He said there's a throne, and from the throne of God, from under the throne of God, in the center of paradise, there flow four rivers. These are the four rivers. And he believes that these four rivers characterize the different kinds of revelation, the different kinds of teaching of the manifestation of God. So what would, say, milk be? Nourishment, yes, it is nourishment, but also it builds bones. It has a very solid proteiny effect. So this stands for the laws, particularly laws and ordinances. And then water. Water has to do with, generally in scriptures, with what? Purity, it has to do with cleansing. It also has to do with baptism of water and fire. Do you remember what the water stands for there? The teaching? The teaching of God to us. In other words, it has to do with knowledge. Fire has to do with love, and water has to do with knowledge. In that instance, Abdu'l Baha explains. To be baptized with water is to be baptized with understanding. So spiritual knowledge and things like the Igan, in that sense, would be like the flowing of doctrinal truths, spiritual truths. Choice sealed wine. Probably all of these things can overlap in one way or another. It just happened to be that we were talking about this division that Abul Fazl gave to it. And some hints you have, but that's the good. It's associated. But also wine is associated with intoxication. And so it may have to do with also the spiritual teaching, I mean spiritual or mystical teachings of the faith. And then honey could be prayer, perhaps. That sense is both nourishment and sweetness. There are different ways that you can look at that. The whole idea is that to think in terms of these very fixed categories, actually signifying spiritual things.
Did Mirza Abul Fazl discuss this in something that's translated into English?
Yes, it's in the introduction to Baha'i Proofs, an introductory essay. What else? Do you remember anything else? We have this judgment scene. Rendering accounts. Okay. What else? That's a good one. Detached souls inspire the arts and sciences. We read that they are the leaven of arts and sciences in the world of being. Pure and detached souls. So in somehow they'll be mediating to the intelligence of man in this world. I'm so curious.
One thing that's hard for me to understand is how could you be attached to anything when you're in the Alpha? How could you be attached to?
sure there are things. I mean, if you have a consciousness in reality, then that's it. It's not object. Thing. Process is a thing, or activity is attached to it.
I don't want to go help the teaching work because it's so comfortable here in paradise. The concourse has to work too hard. And I have my lovely little orchard here with my spiritual flowers. And there are these prayers where it says, you know, assist me to be detached from all things in earth and heaven. There are things in heaven you can get attached to. Maybe your spiritual station. Maybe you'll be attached to your shortcomings. Maybe you'll be attached to your self-pity. Who knows? Not your self-pity, but I mean a person's self-pity could be attached. Maybe you'll be attached to your anger at God because you didn't have all the things in this life just the way you wanted and there was something that happened and you kind of blame God in your heart and you're holding this. People happen. This happens to people, strangely. Well, everybody's talking about all the things in the other world that are pleasant and nice. Nobody's mentioned the other things that we've read about. Those are also activities in the other world, it seems. Deprivations, experiencing aridity and deprivation, the spirit experiencing deep remorse for the opportunities lost in this life. So there's a whole range of feelings that can take place. Now we've had a few other hints when we've read passages that have to do with, for instance, the hidden word where the name of the one that was sore tried in the claws of the dogs of earth, and then it says the inmates of paradise fell down on the dust and wept and beat themselves and so on. And there are dreams that Baha'u'llah has that are recited, accounts that are given in God Passes By, where he talks about the spiritual ones, the holy ones in the other world, lamenting at what's happening to the manifestation of God in this world. So there must be a lot of information, a lot of awareness about all kinds of things that are going on. Then we read last week that they lament, the souls in the other world lament and rejoice in the victories, the spiritual victories that we have or don't have in this life, in this world. So one of the things they do is they see this world from that world. So that's another activity. The points that we had listed here are not inclusive of all of these, but in one way or another they are. That we have listed spiritual association amongst the loved ones, the knowledge of divine mysteries, that service to God is possible, the diffusion of the divine fragrances, detached souls, leavening the arts and sciences, the use of prayer, the ability to pray, the mediation of the Holy Spirit, being mediators of this Holy Spirit of the manifestation, and then some notes on the increased influence of souls after death. Or we can easily understand if they're going to leaven the arts and sciences, they would have a tremendous influence. But there are other promises in this regard. So, again, we'll be reading these quotations. Some of them will be the confirmation of things we've just mentioned. We'll be repeating them again. And some of them will be fresh. At least we'll hear them within the context of the writings themselves. Just a word of, you know, being curious about this for years. I got started with notebooks with sheets in them that I keep around. These two whole notebooks are everywhere sold here because they're the student notebooks that the kids always have for school. And I had some sheets of newsprint and other cheap paper cut up and two holes put through them, punched. And I keep a pile of them around. When I'm studying anything, I'm studying some particular subject for some other reason, and I come across something that bears on this subject, then I would take a note of it. I would write it out by hand, usually, because I find that copying it, looking at it, copying it, identifying where it's from and putting it in a pile of papers helps me to remember that it's there, helps to set it in my mind rather than just noticing it on the page, very active, having to copy it. Then I put these handwritten sheets in piles gradually. Everything that had to do with immortality, at first I started off with some limited area of immortality, like the soul in the other world. And then I saw so many references to immortality, attaining to immortal life and serving the cause of God here. So that whole first part of this course that has to do with the character of immortality as being another condition of the soul while we're living here, one which we would want to attain if we're going to partake of the blessings of eternal life in the hereafter. And that was also confirmed in certain texts. So then I expanded it two ways. The piles were about anything that had to do with eternal life and the blessings of eternal life here in this world, and then whatever it was in the next world. So I pile these things up. Now, you can do this with any subject in the writings that you want. You know, you could search, actually. Maybe you have a very specific subject that you want to hone in on, for instance, reincarnation or something of the sort. And you go and you write, you find everything, you search actually consciously rather than looking for some other subject. You're now searching for reincarnation. But then you find occasionally a quotation in the search for reincarnation which defines the role of the manifestation. And it just happens that you have a collection of quotes on the role of the manifestation and on symbols of the manifestation. You know? So you've got this pile that you keep putting quotes of the manifestation as divine educator, the manifestation as divine physician, the manifestation as the divine gardener, the manifestation as the son of truth, and you're piling those in there because you're going to do something with those sometime too. But meanwhile, you're going through these things on reincarnation, you're finding everything you can find about that, and you're writing it down, Then you get the pile together. Then you look through these, you start reading them, now that you've copied them all down, you read them through. Once, maybe twice, you look at them. And you start to try to feel, how could I organize this material? This quotation says the same as this one. And you start laying them out. And you probably, if you've got many sheets, you want to do this in your bedroom or someplace where you have a big space on the floor and tables and everything, because you'll start making all kinds of different piles. And then you think, well, that should be over here as well. And sometimes you'll find you have to put a note and say that also this such and such a quote over in that pile, it pertains part of it to this. Or you have to start breaking the quotations down into smaller segments. And finally you'll get them there and you begin to build up from those quotations an outline, a subject outline, a topic outline of what you're studying. And put this in some kind of logical order. In other words, you systematize the information available to you in the writings on that subject. And that brings quotations that are very similar to each other, so that you can see what is it that Abdu'l-Bahá, for example, in this explanation of reincarnation, always mentions when he teaches about that. How many different approaches does he have to explaining the question of reincarnation? And when he gives a short answer, what is the essence of the thing that he doesn't leave out? Because you want to be able to answer this question. It's going to arise in your teaching work. And then you'll find the juxtaposition of different examples with this subject. And you'll find some stories and accounts which will add special kind of color to when you want to teach this thing. For instance, one of the short answers, lovely short answers, I probably have mentioned this here earlier in the course. Abdu'l-Bahá was asked about, didn't he think that in order for God to be just, that we'd have to be able to come back and live here again? And if we'd lived here poor, then we would come back and be rich, or if we were abused and treated badly here, then we'd have to come back and be treated well, and so on. They asked Abdu'l-Bahá what he thought about that, and he said that no merciful God would make any soul pass through this world twice. Now, that's something that kind of rings in everybody's hearts. Everybody's sympathetic with that, because no matter how good their situation is, they're not really keen about coming back twice. I mean, unless you don't think there's another world altogether. And the only choice is to come back here, and you say, well, okay, I'll settle with that. But otherwise, nobody wants to go through this again, you know. Once is enough. And that kind of appeals to people's logic. Anyway, this is a way that you can study, or perhaps you do study that way, or perhaps you have a method that works better than that. Maybe you have a notebook with alphabetical tabs, and you write these quotations on subjects there to start off. but then you may wish to take it into a further state of organization. The thing I like about notebook sheets is that you can keep moving them around, and even when you change your mind later, you can move these sheets over here, and when you finally have them in an order you like, you can number them in some sequential pattern, and then you can go through the notebook and take out your five or ten favorite quotations, because you're going to give a little deepening or a little fireside. You have those quotes out and you talk about it, or you draw a few of these and a few of those and a few of another notebook, because that's, you want to have a kind of introduction to the Baha'i teachings on spiritual topics, so you take a little of everything. Then when you're finished, you can go load them back in. They're all coded in some way, and you can get them back into the notebooks where they go. And gradually you build up 2 notebooks, 5 notebooks, 20 notebooks. I think I've got about 22 notebooks, something like that, on different subjects like this. And it helps. Now you've got the computer to assist you. It's good if you do some of it by hand, because you want to know what's in the book. You want to understand the range of subjects and where to find them. And somehow searching just with a computer with a title of a book and coming in pieces, you never know the size and the kind of the weight of the book and the full horizon of that particular volume. So you need a little of both. But then after you've done that, to be able to search and find things quickly, the computer is a blessing from God, from which I hope we don't have to detach ourselves in the other world. And now, this is from Baha'u'llah, and now concerning thy question, whether human souls continue to be conscious one of another after their separation from the body. Know thou that the souls of the people of Baha, who have entered and been established within the Crimson Ark, shall associate and commune intimately one with another, and shall be so closely associated in their lives, their aspirations, their aims and strivings, as to be even as one soul. They are indeed the ones who are well informed, who are keen-sighted, and who are endued with understanding. Thus hath it been decreed by him who is the all-knowing, the all-wise. Where's that from? Gleam, that's right. Page 167. The people of Baha, who are the inmates of the Ark of God, are, one and all, well aware of one another's state and condition. Good heavens. You can see why you'd want to be honest and clean and wholesome and everything in the next world. Everybody's aware of one another's state and condition. And beside that, they're united in bonds of intimacy and fellowship. Such a state, however, must depend upon their faith and their conduct. They that are of the same grade and station are fully aware of one another's capacity, character, accomplishments, and merits. They that are of a lower grade, however, are incapable of comprehending adequately the station or of estimating the merits of those that rank above them. Each shall receive his share from thy Lord. Blessed is the man that hath turned his face towards God and walked steadfastly in his love until his soul hath winged its flight unto God, the sovereign Lord of all, the most powerful, the ever-forgiving, the all-merciful. Where is that from? You know? It's also from Baha'u'llah. It's Galini's page 170. It's a very interesting, very revealing passage. Then Abdul Baha in a tablet says, the real meeting consists in the communication of heart, or of the heart. I hope that this communication will become strong, for the hearts which are spiritually related to each other, their meetings are eternal, both in this world and in the universe of God. The Tablets of Abdul Baha, page 589. again, a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá, he says, as to the question whether the souls will recognize each other in the spiritual world, this fact is certain. For the kingdom is the world of vision, where all the concealed realities will become disclosed. How much more the well-known souls will become manifest. The mysteries of which man is heedless in this earthly life, those will he discover in the heavenly world. And there will he be informed of the secret of truth. How much more will he recognize or discover persons with whom he hath been associated. Undoubtedly, the holy souls who find a pure eye and are favored with insights will in the kingdom of light be acquainted with all mysteries and will seek the bounty of witnessing the reality of every great soul. Even they will manifestly behold the beauty of God in that world. Likewise, will they find all the friends of God, both those of the former and recent times, present in the heavenly assemblage. And know thou for a certainty that in the divine worlds, the spiritual beloved ones will recognize each other and will seek union with each other, but a spiritual union. Likewise, the love that one may have entertained for anyone will not be forgotten in the world of the kingdom. Moreover, thou wilt not forget, or likewise thou wilt not forget there, the life that thou hast had in the material world. Pages 205 and 206 of the volume 1 of the tablets. What do you think it means? Do you have any idea? How do we feel when we look in each other's eyes, we look in each other's face, when we really like each other, or when we feel that each other have spiritual qualities? You have a deep appreciation of someone, you look at them and with sympathy, and they look back, and there is a communication, you know? There's something very real that goes to cementing us together. Think of the communication between a mother and their small children, the love that goes back and forth between them, all these communications of heart, and it's spiritual something. People can say with words that they love you and that they admire you and everything, but that has to be accompanied by the reality of the communication of the heart, which affirms it, confirms it. And it has to do with spiritual feelings, I think. And as Abdu'l-Bahá says, it's the real communication. Even thanksgiving, he says, thanksgiving in this day, the essence of thanksgiving is not the, oh God, thanks be unto thee, by itself, he says, but rather the illumination of the heart, the excitement of the heart, as a result of witnessing or perceiving the bounties of God. Then the heart rejoices, begins to dance, exult. This is thanksgiving. This is true thanksgiving. This is what thrills God to. This is what God responds to. That's the thought that comes in my head at the moment. Now, we have a lot of spiritual Baha'is here. We've got some other ideas you should say. Communication of the heart, please.
I have a question. I was thinking about this quote, which I've been meaning to look up. I don't know if it's authentic, but you would probably know. It's a mantra of Baha, and it says, out of the fusion of two souls, a very subtle entity is born, which has neither... it's immune from the forces of time and distance and space. Are you familiar?
That sounds like something in an article by Rosemary Sala.
Oh.
That was, you know, having to do with soulmates. It was kind of the basis upon which the believers understood that there must be such a thing as a soulmate. fusion of souls, but I'm not sure. But that reminds me of that, and I would be a little wary of it until I double-checked it. But there is something that grows between souls, whether it's meant to just grow between two souls, I'm not sure. Seems to have a broader implications for the organic unity, spiritual unity of the body of the believers. He calls upon the believers to be so united that we all have the same hands and same feet and same eyes, you know, it's that kind of unity, single entity unity. We have examples in nature of that kind of unity. When you think of a school of fish where the slightest movement in the water, you've seen this thing. The whole school of fish, every fish reacts spontaneously, or the fish species reacts and it turns. That particular species, everybody does the same thing. There seems to be something common in packs or herds or in animals that runs between them, a common feeling that they respond to and alert each other all spontaneously, very quickly. You know, they don't have to, one fish says to the next one, there's a danger over there, and he turns, and then everybody turns. It doesn't happen that way. It's just suddenly they all move. Communication of the heart. This is this unseen flow of emails at the World Center that nobody is able to monitor. Probably there's a lot of communication of the heart going on. But there, in that spiritual world, Adwa says, he will look upon and comprehend all things with his inner eye. There will he gaze on his fellows and his peers and those in the ranks above him and those below. Their equal status is at the beginning of their existence. The differentiation followeth their passing away. And we've had other passages that deal with this, that the souls are all equal at their birth. But then they position themselves according to their deeds, according to their merits, according to their activities, according to their spiritual victories. And these differences will become clear, particularly in the next world. Another tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá, he says, as to thy question regarding discoveries made by the soul after it hath put off its human form. So we'll be discovering. Certainly that world is a world of perceptions and discoveries. For the interposed veil will be lifted away, and the human spirit will gaze upon souls that are above, below, and on a par with itself. It is similar to the condition of a human being in the womb, where his eyes are veiled and all things are hidden away from him. Once he is born out of the uterine world and entereth this life, he findeth it, with relation to that of the womb, to be a place of perceptions and discoveries. And he observeth all things through his outer eye. In the same way, once he hath departed this life, he will behold in that world whatsoever was hidden from him here. But there he will look upon and comprehend all things with his inner eye. There will he gaze on his fellows and his peers, and those in ranks above and those below. And as for what is meant by the equality of souls in the all-highest realm, it is this. The souls of the believers at the time when they first became manifest in the world of the body are equal, and each is sanctified and pure. In this world, however, they will begin to differ one from another, some achieving the highest station, some a middle one, others remaining at the lowest stage of being. Their equal status is at the beginning of their existence. the differentiation followeth their passing away. It's the selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 170, 171. Yes. The first quotation we read, there was this sentence: "They that are of a lower grade, however, are incapable of comprehending adequately the station or of estimating the merits of those that rank above them." Of adequately. So I think it tells us that just as in this life we know that there are souls that we see, we recognize they're higher souls than we are. You know, we just see that they're farther along the path, their spiritual perception is more, everything. And we see them there, but we don't know what it is they know more than us. It's clear to me that they know more. You know, it's something you just realize. You know, this soul is the embodiment of love, of tender love, spiritual love. Anybody that gets near them feels drawn and magnetized by this, and it has an effect. You know, you see people like that. Then you think of it. I suppose we don't fully understand it. We get happy about it. But it's beyond us to really kind of fathom the station of a martyr. And yet the martyrs, the spirit of the martyrs, will be communicated to us in some way. The effect of it surely has already affected us. But how much more when we meet them in the other world and they recount to us how they walk through fire and what the confirmations of Baha'u'llah were and how he came to them and what he did. You know, all of these things will have a deep effect on us. So we can benefit from them, but we benefit from them within our own circle of knowledge and understanding that has to do with our particular degree of growth and development. This is the way I understand. In other words, we're not blinded by them, but we're not in the same intimate association that we would be with those that are similar grade with us. You had asked concerning the disclosure of spirits after the dissolution of bodies. This is the same quotation in another translation. You want to hear two translations? It's a little different. This is an older one. You had asked concerning the disclosure of spirits after the dissolution of bodies. Undoubtedly, the other world is a world of disclosure and vision. For there the veil will be removed and the human spirit will witness the souls above it, beneath it, and of an equal rank with it. So this tells us he will see the souls that are higher. When he departs from this world into the other world, whatever was veiled from him in this world will become disclosed to him in the other. And in that world he will comprehend and perceive all things with the eye of insight and will witness those like him, equal to him, above him or outside of him. This is a further quotation from the Fortnightly Review, April 1918, citing teachings of Abdu'l-Bahá. This is a British magazine. Love will unite all those whom physical death has parted. But it must be remembered that we can only be in perfect touch with those on the same plane of development as ourselves. It is so here, but we are not so acutely conscious of it now as we shall be. You see? You can understand perfectly those below you, but not those in advance of you, though they can come down to you. It is the same law as we find in this world. The mineral kingdom is distinct in its conditions from the vegetable. Impossible for the mineral to conceive of the kingdom of powers of the vegetable, which grows and changes from a seed into a flower or a tree, drawing its nutriment from earth and air and water. So again, it is impossible for the vegetable to conceive of the kingdom above it, the animal whose powers and senses so entirely transcend its own. Equally, the animal can never comprehend the works of man's brain, for man alone of all the animals is not governed by the conditions in which he finds himself. He has no fins, but he conquers the sea. He conquers the night by creating for himself light, the cold by making heat, his limited senses by supplementing and extending them. He assails heaven itself that he may rise to God, his Father and Creator. To the animals other than man, the attainments of man are inconceivable, just as inconceivable as the next plane above and beyond this is now to us. For there we shall find new powers, new senses, as far transcending these we have as they transcend the powers of those on the plains below us. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá'in, in the tablets where he speaks about the divisions of spirit, in some answered questions he mentions five divisions of the spirit. Remember? He doesn't start with mineral there. He's given a condensed version sometimes. Sometimes he gives a more expanded version. In the expanded version, there's also the mineral spirit. But generally, in some answered questions, he talks about the vegetable spirit, the animal spirit, the human spirit, the spirit of faith, and the Holy Spirit. And he describes those and how they relate to each other. And each one is above, and the difference of degree means that they can't be understood. Now, this one man understands the kingdoms below him, and through the influence of the Holy Spirit, he attains to the additional power of the spirit of faith, which endows him with this eye of insight and enables him to perceive spiritual realities and to intuit divine understanding from scripture and from experience. Now, in other tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá names the stages of the soul, and he goes through from the mineral and comes up to the human rational. And then he begins a series in the same sense. It's, for instance, they will all be in one set of definitions, he calls them all nafs. This is a word for soul. In another tablet, he uses the same scale, but he calls them ruh. So you have ruhe insani, or nafsi insani, means the human soul or the human spirit. But after he gets to the highest stage of this rational speaking, the speaking animal, man the speaking animal, man the creature of speech, then he starts into spiritual conditions. And he describes the inspired soul, and he describes the detached soul, the perfect soul, the soul who's pleasing unto God, the soul of the kingdom, the soul of the dominion on high, describes these various planes and describes the characteristics of these stages. And he started with mineral, vegetable, animal, and then he goes on up the scale. So this idea that we say, well, yes, but the differences between a mineral and a vegetable, or between a vegetable and an animal, this is so great. How can you compare the differences between souls to that, those kind of differences? How is it that we wouldn't comprehend? And yet he's telling us there's this scale difference. There are these major breaks and movement into new conditions of soul that we really can't comprehend. And the souls of what he calls the kingdom are very high indeed. I mean, that's like coming up to the end of the seven valleys or something. So we may see each other in the kingdom, but we may not understand everything we see. We may have a lot to learn, and we may be taught. I don't know. Mr. Olinga told me that he'd had some experiences where he was taken to the next world and sat in a large assemblage where there was this center. They sat around a center where there was this tremendous fountain of light, he said, and everyone just thrilled. This fountain would pulse, and the waves and emanations would come off and bathe everyone, and they would just be gradually imbued with understanding of whatever subject it was that the fountain was giving forth. Now, who knows the reality of this dream? He says it's a dream, but at the same time, it gives you the impression of in what ways may we be educated, or may our spiritual lives be enriched in the next world through this witnessing of the divine light, through the pure form of the beauty of God pouring out of the manifestations of God. Just cleanse us and wash away all that which we don't need to have in our being. Gradually draw us into fuller spiritual experience. I suppose that could happen to us here now, if we wanted to pursue it too. If you got up and went all the way across Africa to open a virgin state of Africa, and you were there all alone, and the enemies of the faith were after you all the time, you might have some dreams like that too, I suppose. Question, can disembodied souls communicate with embodied ones? Master says, yes, but they do not do it through mediums or material ways, but in spiritual ways. This is cited in the Star of the West from a tablet and an editorial. From a tablet in an editorial entitled Psychic Forces. And these notes were made from the words of Abdu'l-Bahá when he was in America in 1912. Later, a copy of the notes was submitted to Abdu'l-Bahá in August 1914 by Mrs. Hoag, Emma Jean Hoag. While she was in Haifa, the notes, as quoted, are a copy of the corrected copy. To tamper with psychic forces while in this world interferes with the condition of the soul in the world to come. These forces are real, but are not to be active on this plane. The child in the matrix has its eyes, ears, hands, and feet, but these powers are not in activity. The whole purpose of the matrix life is the coming into the world. So the whole purpose of the matrix world life, in other words, this life, is coming forth into the world of reality, where all those forces will become active. They belong to that world. Now this tells us this is very active. There's a psychic world, it's a very active world. And we will use these forces in a normal course of existence in the future. But we shouldn't try to tamper with them here, try to employ them, try to play with them. And if they appear in us spontaneously, we should disregard them, not pursue them, not develop them. Now we have to understand that we are seeking spiritual forces and spiritual development, but not psychic forces. What's the difference? How do we understand the difference? In that problem rests some of the spiritual suspension of the believers, because some of them have understood that any kind of concentration, like prayer or meditation, where you try to abstract yourself from the things of the outside world and concentrate on the blessings and spiritual presence of Baha'u'llah, so to speak, is like as if you're using psychic forces again. Yes? Yes. I don't think that the psychic seems to be more in the realm of telepathy and telecommunication and the kind of things that mediums purport to do, you know, or the material realization of trying to make things out of nothing by mental forces and things of this sort. I think this is what's generally explained in the religious teachings of the past to us, psychic forces. I don't know, I wouldn't want to say how it applies to vision quest of the Native Americans, which seem to be, has a much higher character and is connected with fasting and prayer and putting oneself again in this abstract condition so that one might wait for a vision. I mean, you can't produce the vision, but you at least are receptive to it. I don't know how it works. It's not the form that's given in the Baha'i writings, although we're told to meditate and we're given powerful prayers to repeat. The Bab has prescribed some prayers which you say 1,000 times in one sitting, you know. There are such things. What effective it will be to free you from your troubles and so on. You were going to add something, please. Well, it's a very delicate area. I mean, you can't say what they should do and shouldn't do, but if they're Baha'is, then the question arises, you know, how much do you participate? The Sundance, for instance, has a ceremony where you pierce the chest and hang, the warrior is hung up on a, in the sun in the center of the Sun Lodge and hangs there for a while. Should Baha'is, or do Baha'is need such an experience? No. It becomes an interesting question about Baha'u'llah has removed the rituals and ceremonies of the past. He's assigned certain ones, and the rest he's left behind. So there's some things that, I mean, some of the dances and some of the other things that seem more acceptable within as cultural expressions, maybe spiritual cultural expressions, but it's hard to know just where do you draw the line? This is this question that arises now. The whole Native American church is based on the use of peyote. And they say that there's not a drug, it's like a medicinal thing that they use to cleanse themselves, to prepare them, connect themselves with the Great Spirit. And yet the Baha'i teachings condemn all forms of hallucinogenics and drugs of that nature. So there's a conflict there. So that the Native Americans who become Baha'is have to resolve these questions. Have you heard discussions on the same? I'm sure you have. Is it?
How much bigger they, you know, I don't know,
nothing is different from what she's talking.
Dr. Garber, who was here from the Soviet Union visiting the World Center last month, one of his areas of study was shamans and also Tibetan priests and meditators, and studying the physiological conditions of these individuals when they were in states of deep meditation or when they were in the act of healing or so on. And they identified, I don't remember all the technical names, John knows the technical names of the things that are released in the bloodstream or something, the same type of things that are released in the bloodstream of these individuals in these conditions are the same type of things, in some cases, that are released by hallucinogenics, by drugs. There is a parallel condition induced by these. And they were, he was talking about the power of healing that comes from thinking healing, you know. And actually they've had clinical studies to develop this, to see how much a thought has an influence and prayer has an influence. He says it's definitely proven prayer has a powerful influence in the well-being and healing of the human body. Now this is a Soviet who doesn't have a religion, says he's an atheist, but I mean, they've been more forward in their studies in these areas than we have been in the West, where we have so-called religion, and we say it's religion, say this and that, but we more or less don't take it very seriously. But they saw that there were some powers in this. They want to know what powers there are. Are there powers that the state should know about in such things? You know? Not to prove religion, but to see of powers that are part of the human reality which can be used in the service of society. Directed or misdirected or whatever, but still that are there to be tapped.
Question, what is the difference between using psychic forces and spiritual forces? And the few things that were mentioned to differentiate the two were under psychic forces, telepathy, ritual, ceremony, and hallucinogenics. And under spiritual forces, things like meditation, prayer, and being in a receptive state. And trying to me, the areas are still, there still is some ambiguity between.
There is definitely lots of ambiguity.
That's just it.
It depends on your motive, first of all. The psychic is usually, you know, for some personal advantage. I mean, people, you want to read people's thoughts, or you want to impress upon them, or you want to foretell future events. You want access to certain things that you don't really need access to. I mean, you say, God is going to guide me. I pray to God. I put my affairs in His hand. But instead of this, I want to see around the corner and see what's coming and deal with it in some way, you know. Ouija boards and automatic writing, trying to get spirits to help us, to guide us to messages on Ouija boards and things like that. But I do get messages, and they're, I mean, great messages, you know. Is it bad to forecast?
I don't think so. I hope not.
That's not what I'm saying. I don't. I mean, I hope I'm not saying that. I'm
no,
saying this.
Because to forecast, not try to forecast by using psychic forces, rather to forecast using really logical
trends and things of that sort. That's, these are legitimate. That's different, I think, from employing psychic forces to figure out something. I don't know. It's just. There's a whole list of psychic activities, psychic practices, you know, ESP and clairvoyance and all these different powers which do appear at times in this world. But Abdu'l-Bahá says, don't entertain them, I mean, don't pursue them, so to speak. Well, I think the same Bushmen, also Native peoples, many places, to some extent also the Native Americans, they're all perceptive about sincerity and things that have to do with how true people are, how true they are in their relations with others, or how true they are in their relationship with God. But that's a generalization, doesn't apply to all the people. Some of them are degenerated to the point where they don't understand and experience such things. Let's go on reading these quotes, because each one of them adds a little something. I mean, obviously we're dealing with things that nobody clearly understands. I don't pretend to understand it either. But you get some pattern, some picture from it. Regarding your question, in his chapter, this is from a letter written on behalf of the Guardian, in his chapter on visions and communications with spirits and some answered questions, the Master evidently desires to point out that there can be, under certain rare circumstances, such as those experienced by the prophets, communion with some soul gone before into the invisible world, but that most of this type of experience, which people often claim to have with departed souls, is nothing but the product of their own imaginations, however real it may seem to them to be. Regarding your question in connection with someone's desire to be informed about table writing and such things, though there is no specific reference in the teachings to this particular thing, Shoghi Effendi feels very strongly that in view of other statements about avoiding all psychic dabbling and exercise of psychic faculties, this should also be avoided by the Baha'is and such messages be disregarded. There is no ambiguity about the Master's attitude towards psychic forces. He very strongly warned the believers against using them. What Abdu'l-Bahá always pointed out in this matter is that these psychic powers were not to be used in this world, and that indeed it was dangerous to cultivate them here. They should be left dormant and not exploited, even when we do so with the sincere belief we are helping others. We do not understand their nature and have no way of being sure of what is true and what is false in such matters. If children are inclined to be psychic, they should not be blamed for it too harshly. They should not be encouraged to strengthen their powers in this direction. As regards your question about the members who still cling to psychic practices, he hopes that by now all those who became active in the new center you established have given up attending seances and psychical practices. If they have not, they should do so. That finishes this, those particular direct references to psychic practices. Now we come into the question of more on visions and dreams themselves. This is from a tablet of the Master. He says, "Thou didst ask as to the transfiguration of Jesus with Moses and Elias and the Heavenly Father on Mount Tabor, as referred to in the Bible. This occurrence was perceived by the disciples with their inner eye, wherefore it was a secret hidden away and was a spiritual discovery of theirs. Otherwise, if the intent be that they witnessed physical forms, that is, witnessed that transfiguration with their outward eyes, then there were many others at hand on that plain and mountain. And why did they fail to behold it? And why did the Lord charge them that they should tell no man? It is clear that this was a spiritual vision and a scene of the kingdom. Wherefore did the Messiah bid them to keep this hidden till the Son of Man were risen from the dead? That is, until the cause of God should be exalted and the word of God prevail and the reality of Christ rise up." Selections from the Writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 162. I don't know, it's got into the Gospels, and that's where we see it. Well, they were compiled and published about 300 years after Christ. It's about the time of Constantine's conversion. "That truth is often imparted through dreams." No one, this is Shoghi Effendi, letter on behalf of Shoghi Effendi. "That truth is often imparted through dreams, no one who is familiar with history, especially religious history, can doubt. At the same time, dreams and visions are always colored and influenced more or less by the mind of the dreamer, and we must beware of attaching too much importance to them. The purer and more free from prejudice and desire our hearts and minds become, the more likely is it that our dreams will convey reliable truth. But if we have strong prejudices, personal likings and aversions, bad feelings or evil motives, these will warp and distort any inspirational impression that comes to us. In many cases, dreams have been the means of bringing people to the truth or of confirming them in the faith. We must strive to become pure in heart and free from all save God. Then our dreams, as well as our waking thoughts, will become pure and true. We should test impressions we get through dreams, visions, or inspirations by comparing them with the revealed word and seeing whether they are in harmony therewith." So that's your standard. May 16th, 1925. I think it's been published in... the first book of compilations that the Indian Publishing Trust put out has some of these compilations that the House of Justice published. One of them is on dreams and psychic powers and visions and things. And this is printed there. It is in print, circulated. And I think it's probably been put into Lights of Guidance. You could check those two sources. This one's out of a file at the World Center. Regarding your question relative to the condition of those people who are described in the Gospel as being possessed of devils, this should be interpreted figuratively. Devil or Satan is symbolic of evil and dark forces yielding to temptation. This question oftentimes arises with Christians. The devil made me do it. Evil and dark forces yielding to temptation. First, concerning visions, it's very difficult to distinguish between true visions, which are true spiritual experiences of the soul, and imaginations, which have no reality in spiritual truths. True visions, however, can be granted to those who are spiritually pure and receptive, and are not, therefore, confined to the prophets alone. The Guardian thinks that it is best to assume that, generally speaking, when people claim they are receiving messages or communications from the Master or Baha'u'llah, it is a psychic experience or their imagination, and that they are not in real contact with them. These holy beings have channels of the cause through which to guide us. They do not need to go outside these and send individual revelations. So if you think, well, oh, but, you know, so-and-so had a vision, Baha'u'llah is telling us all to do this or that. Well, he has the administrative order, he has a whole series of channels through which he communicates to the believers. These may or may not be helpful guidance to us as individuals, but sometimes they are. We're free to look at them ourselves, you know. Now we can tell others about them, but we certainly can't expect others to act on our dreams or visions if we have them. And even, Shoghi Effendi says, we should be cautious about acting on them ourselves. First, we should line them up against the revelation, because he said all these various factors warp and distort the inspiration that comes to the soul, so that one can put one's own meaning on such things and then say, this is Baha'u'llah's will for me because I had this dream and I understand this to mean this and this to mean that. And find out what it says in the Gleanings. Find out what it says in the Advent of Divine Justice. See what the teaching is. That's about all we have to depend on. We can pray and ask for guidance for the meaning, to understand the meaning of the dream. Perhaps we'll get some help that way. The Master would sometimes interpret the dreams very specifically. Sometimes he would say such and such a thing in a dream means such and such. Then you've got a clue in case you've had those particular symbols. But he talks about three kinds of dreams. One produced by the activities of the day, which is a kind of nervous impressions that continue. You know, you've been working on the word processor all day and you do it all night. Or you've been trimming a hedge and you continue trimming the hedge the rest of the night and you're tired and you wake up in the morning. That's one kind of dream. Then the second kind is this symbolic dreams, where things are expressed in symbols and in parables and things. And one has to somehow work out the meaning of it, discover what the meaning of it is. I remember Dr. J. Carey said, two nights before the Guardian died, he had a dream. Shoghi Effendi was standing next to a small table in a room, and there were coins on this table, and he was picking up the coins. had a handful of the coins, and he took the coins and he started breaking the coins and dropping the pieces, breaking the coins, dropping the pieces, breaking the coins, dropping the pieces. He was very impressed with it. He said, I've had a dream with Shoghi Effendi. And she said, I did too. I had a dream too. So he asked her, what was your dream? She said, I dreamed that Shoghi Effendi was standing in a room by a table, and it was a pile of plates on that table, and he was taking the plates one at a time and throwing them to the floor and breaking them. Then he told her about the broken coins. And several days later, they heard of the garden. So here you have it. I mean, you know, they found out the meaning. I mean, they could understand somehow the meaning or the hint that they were being given ahead of time.
I think I remember reading in the Seven Valleys. I don't remember which valley it was, of course. Never remember where it was.
It's pretty good if you can remember that it's in the Seven Valleys. That's a start. That's very good.
Anyway, he says that the wayfarers in this valley will be able to understand
the specific kind of dream. I will
look it up.
Okay. Fair enough. The third kind of dream is the dream which is a clear dream and is a spiritual disclosure in which things are quite clear. You see, he embraces you, he gives you some juice to drink, he showers his love upon you, or you see one of the spiritual beings, perhaps even the manifestation of God, and it excites and renews your vision. So maybe, if you're privileged. Good luck. It's all right. Do you remember this other letter I read a little before we came to this subject? He says that for the most part, the experiences of the people who dream, even of the master and the manifestation, these may be the imaginations here. So we don't know, you know, it's a question. Even though they seem very real to us. Please. Okay.
I don't know if it's a thief of night to answer questions, but either Bill Sears or Echo Mahan says that none of the proofs in the Bible are actual things that a Baha'i cannot understand. That none of the symbolism there are things that are something nobody has any relationship with. Like one part of the symbolism is clearly understood in one context and the other part in a different context, and we just have to be able to put the pieces together. I think that's probably true of symbolism in dreams. If it's meant to tell you something, it's not going to be something you have no chance of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
There's some link that you can understand.
Yes, there should be. Of course, these things in the Bible, I remember there's several tablets of the Master where he told the friends, you know, that the meaning of this verse is such and such. He said, but turn to the kingdom and turn your being wholly towards the Lord. And he will supply you, you know, he will provide you with inspiration that you can understand all the symbols of the Bible, that you can expound on all the meanings of the verses of the holy books. So that power is promised there to the soul too. In other words, the same condition we're talking about where one is receptive and can commune with souls beyond and feel the closeness of the manifestation is the same and endows you with an eye with which to look at the scriptures and to derive the hidden meanings and the hidden gift that we read about in the prayers for the fast. Well, one more quote on this subject and then we'll finish here. Someone has written a guardian, they're doing automatic writing and some painting, waiting for electric kind of inspirations and then painting things, you know, and so on. So he writes back, this is a very nice believer too, he says, he feels that the methods you are pursuing in regard to receiving inspired written messages and your way of approaching your painting are really psychic, and that you should give them up for your own good. Some of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l Baha's tablets are so poorly translated that it is almost impossible to grasp the true meaning, and one is misled into thinking that by getting into a practically psychic state, the Holy Spirit will guide one. This is not what is meant. The world's greatest writers and painters have not been under psychic influence, but through innate ability, practice, and study have given us their masterpieces. This is the normal way for inspiration to reach us, through the channels of our own abilities, and not through control by forces which the Master warned us against, and which we do not understand, and which, as you yourself know, are neither consistent nor reliable. Because the lady wrote that in her letter to the Guardian. So that gives us another way of looking at this thing. I don't know if this is published. I don't believe it's published. If we could take a date on it, it's February 24th, 1947. Well, friends, you see on the breakdown of the topics, there is another subject there on martyrdom. Condition of martyrs, mystery of martyrdom. And I never have compiled anything much on that. It was one of the topics that was there that wasn't explored, but I felt should be added to this. But I recommend that we're not going to have a class on that. I recommend that you turn to the latest volume of the Baha'i World, the Crimson Volume. It has a section on the Baha'i sacred writings, and has a compilation there from the writings of Baha'u'llah, and then from Abdu'l-Baha and Shoghi Effendi. All unpublished, previously unpublished tablets and messages about this subject of sacrifice and martyrdom and so on. And it's a thrilling selection of writings that no Baha'i should go without reading. But sometimes, because it's in that volume, not published in a separate book, we don't know it's there, and we don't realize that they're nowhere else to be seen. And it was a tremendous work of the research department here and of the House of Justice to prepare these for that volume. What's the name of the Persian compilation that it comes from that was also created here? Narvanur is taken from a Persian compilation that was prepared also by the World Center on this subject. And then the last section is the prayers for the departed. And you can look in your prayer book, you can find those, and there are other sources you can find from time to time. Some of the compilations on immortality have additional prayers. There's a new one now in the prayer book, but it's in the selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Baha on this subject. Now, the next course that we've been planning on for a long time is the study of the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And this will be coming up now. And I think, let's see, I want to have a break for a couple weeks and then start that course. So let us say we'll begin that course on Sunday night, April 8th. So we'll have a couple Sundays free. 25th and the 1st will be free. And then we'll take up our studies again, for those of you that want to attend that course, starting on April 8th, Sunday, April 8th. Please. Sure. Well, may my life be offered up for thee. May I become a sacrifice at your threshold. May I be a martyr, is one meaning. But within that meaning, I think, is the may I be a martyr who will you take me my physical life, because I offer that, or would you take my living martyrdom, because I offer that. You know, the writings talk about these two kinds. One is living martyrdom, and one is giving oneself actually as a physical sacrifice for the cause. In other words, being willing to do that. not simply a polite phrase. I mean, we're saying, oh, may my soul be offered up. May my spirit be a ransom for the adversities thou didst sustain. He gives us these verses. Now we should see how we can bring our hearts into alignment with that outlook, with the willingness, you know. How do we want to die? I mean, we're going to get old and we're going to get sore and we're going to get cranky and probably feel bad and have certain things ache and maybe certain things rot away inside of us, and then we're going to die in our bed going gargle, gargle, and then die. Now, do you want to do that, or would you rather maybe a little before that, while you're still on your feet, be chopped down by some assassin, some persecutor of the cause? Quick, easy, gone, you know, that you've offered yourself. You have, by your blood, you have offered something for the cause. Your sacrifice, the spirit that generates in those around you, because you've given your life for the cause, you haven't denied the cause, you've stood up and you've given your life for the cause, quickens the world and has an effect that throws you also into the supreme concourse. Or you can take your chances. Maybe you'll just fall asleep sometime when you're in your easy chair in front of your television and you'll drift off to the Abba kingdom. Now, what is this? I'm giving this, you know, kind of harsh contrast, because we don't think it through, you know. We think, oh, how could I do that? You know, how could I be killed for the faith? You're going to die anyway. We're all going to die. Do it in a really splendid way, you know. I don't know. If we have the opportunity, who knows whether we'll have the opportunity or not. But one could ask. One could meditate and think, and one could ask. You know? What did he say in the hidden words? Seek a martyr's death in my path. That's the one I was thinking about. At least if we're open to that, you know, if we've thought it through, if we've worked it through spiritually, and we're open to it, what are we going to be afraid of? I mean, you know, what can happen to us? And then if you read the story of the martyrs, maybe the pain that they had was just for an instant, and then it was gone. They were relieved of any physical part of this thing. They're ecstatic. They were caught up in the arms of Baha'u'llah. He had come to them and talked to them before they were martyred. All the stories are incredible, the ones that were in prison in Iran and the things they suffered. Anyway, this compilation will give you a feeling for that. You end up, you know, wishing that you were nothing but a martyr. If there was anything you could do, at least I could do that. I could be killed for the cause. You know, I don't seem to live the life very well, and I don't seem to get out and pioneer properly, but maybe just I could just give myself some time, you know?
Isn't that the list of the monster?